Hello and welcome to Season 7, Episode 5 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Wednesday the 30th of April and we're going to discuss what's been happening in the news and in the Ubuntu community. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat thing on the website and in the #UPCIRC channel. I'm Laura and joining me this week are Mark.
Hello.
Alan.
Hello.
And Tony.
Good evening.
How are you all?
Great.
Yep, good.
Excellent. Yes.
These two have had a bit of a tiff.
No, we haven't.
Which two?
Oh, sorry, not you.
We're okay. Not talking about it.
Alan and Mark, they're sitting next to each other, staring straight ahead.
Yeah, well, they normally do. Alan doesn't like people to look at him when he's podcasting.
That's why we're not doing the webcam thing.
Yeah. No eye contact.
Yes.
Look away.
Yes.
That's the way I prefer to do it anyway.
Yes.
Yeah. Should we, you know...
It's fine.
Do some news?
Yes, why not?
Sounds like a stress-packed show.
And now it's time for the news. And
well,
after the...
Sorry.
After the departure of Vic Gontora... Gondotra from Google, many news organizations have been spelling the end for Google Plus, the social network he was the lead of.
Oh.
That was the guy you told me to message, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
That'd be why he didn't reply.
Well, he only left last week.
But you're probably thinking about it.
Yeah, that was probably what tipped him over the edge. Yeah. He was like, oh, God, this blooming Laura woman. Get off my back.
So this with this guy, basically, Google Plus was his baby.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
He headed up the division and he left kind of rapidly. He posted about some family issues that kind of triggered him thinking about moving on and what's next in your life and, you know, new stories and, you know, new adventures and so on, and then left.
Some thoughts say he might have been fired.
Yeah, I've seen, you know, as always, there are people who are saying he was a great person to work with and others saying he wasn't so much. And interestingly, in the Silicon Valley area, there's an app called Secret that actually someone mentioned that he was interviewing some days before he actually left the company. So it had leaked out, but whether people were aware of it or not. Yeah. So all the news articles from all the tech press who never use Google Plus are all telling everyone that Google Plus is dead. Most notably, places like TechCrunch. And,
yeah. Well, there was a story saying that Google were going to have to stop forcing all of their other services to integrate with Google Plus because this guy was leaving.
Right.
I don't see where most. Yeah. All of their stuff did seem just to be sort of.
Well, it does seem like they've reallocated resources around other parts of the company, like taking right. and it's a significant number of people that they have working on Google Plus.
Yeah.
It's like a few thousand people working on this social platform that, you know, have been thrown to different parts of the company, like mobile and other parts.
Well, I thought it recently, actually, it just kind of started looking up and being a bit more active.
Yeah. I mean, it, obviously, like any social network, different people, you know, like different ones. Some people love Facebook, some people love Twitter, and others loved Identica for some reason.
Status.net.
Yeah, and Pump.io or whatever.
But Pumpio.
But, you know, Google Plus seems to have been the one that a lot of the tech press have constantly vilified and said is dead or is dying or is a ghost town. And then you get people who are really popular and people who have a lot of followers on Google Plus then respond with, well, surely it's not, given I have this many hundreds of thousands of people following my posts and I get this much engagement or interaction on my posts. And so yeah, it's still wait and see, but
it takes more people to build something than it does to maintain it as well. So
yeah, and it's very easy to write an article saying how rubbish it is and it's all going to fall apart. And
is it?
Oh, yeah.
I might give it a go.
Well, everyone's doing it, Tony. Yeah. You really should. You
it's
should
all the rage, it. Darling.
Yes, exactly. Moving on. The Linux Foundation have announced the Core Infrastructure Initiative, a scheme to provide funding to open source projects that provide key industry standard components. Things like, oh, I don't know, SSL.
Ooh.
Companies backing the initiative include Amazon, Google, IBM, Qualcomm, Facebook, Microsoft, and all the big players you'd expect.
Every single one of them.
Every single one of the big players you expect. The first project,
all the cool kids.
Yes, will be funding is part. The first project that will receive funding is OpenSSL.
Yeah.
Fancy that.
Yes. So is this called the Stable Door project?
Just a bit.
Right, okay.
Yes. Well, it's, you know, it's interesting that they all come running at the point when they realise that this key bit of infrastructure that they absolutely all depend on for, you know, something as important as, oh, I don't know, security.
But, my project didn't need to worry about it.
Why, is everything insecure in your project?
No, obscure, no Heartbleed.
Or a proprietary SSL implementation.
I don't know. I don't think so.
No, just a really good one.
Actually,
you just believed the announcement that says we're not.
I made the announcement.
Oh, okay.
It's all about the little padlock. Got a little padlock, it's secure.
Yeah.
That's the way it goes.
I mean, it's obviously good to see, and, you know, that some of these core bits of infrastructure are going to get funding from big companies that use those projects.
And that's always been the moral but not legal argument around companies supporting the stuff that they use a lot. It's still supposedly cheaper for them to stick a couple of engineers on OpenSSL or Samba or whatever technology they use, Apache, MySQL, you name it, and then it is to license huge proprietary equivalents from closed source software vendors that they then can't tinker with.
I wonder if there are any conspiracy theorists wondering if someone at the Linux Foundation planted this problem in OpenSSL just so they could get funding 2 years later from all of these immense companies that have truckloads of money to throw at this.
Well, it is the internet, so yes, there will be somebody somewhere thinking exactly that.
Yeah, I don't know why that came to me, but there you go.
Yeah. So, turning overseas now to the US, where a magistrate has ruled that companies issued with warrants for customer data must produce that data even if it's stored on a server outside the USA. The ruling comes in response to Microsoft challenge against a warrant to turn over data held in its Dublin data center. Microsoft had previously offered customers a choice as to where their data was held, with the implication that data held outside the US was safe from US authorities.
Yes.
This is quite an interesting and wide-ranging case. It should be noted that Microsoft are appealing this judgment, which has basically been made at a fairly low level in the US judiciary system. And I think quite a lot of commentators expect it to be overturned or countermanded or whatever when it gets slightly higher up the chain.
Surely they'll just move the ownership of core bits of infrastructure to another part of the company. They'll have a subsidiary that's owned by some other part of the company that's based in Liechtenstein or somewhere, you know.
Exactly. And it starts to get very complicated when you're into a company the size of Microsoft anyway, which already has EU subsidiary companies and things. So at what point can one company order another company to do something? The judge's argument was that it wasn't actually US authorities getting the data. It was like a subpoena, which meant that Microsoft had to hand over the data. So it was Microsoft getting the data from its own data center and then handing that over to the US authorities. So no US agents would go to the data center and do anything.
Oh, that's okay then, right.
With a big USB stick.
Yeah, yes.
Yes.
And an aeroplane ticket in their back pocket. So generally conception is that stuff within the EU, well, the European data protection laws mean that anything within the EU is subject to those rules and can't be shared without consent and all that sort of thing. So it implies that anything outside the EU can't inherently have access to data without permission from the users. So you would need to get the user's permission in order to give the data, for example, to the US government, which is why people have data centers in Europe and have data centers in Russia and places like that, where a US agent can't just walk into it, because anything inside the US they can. They can go into data center, or, you know, flash their badge, put on their shades, and
just like the movies,
kick the door down.
Kick the door down, rip the server out of the rack,
and
walk off with it under their arm,
and make a quip as they do.
That Tony hadn't thought of for that bit. Yeah. Laura.
Some more data news. Google's announced Google Apps for Education, the free service for educational institutions, will no longer be used for advertising. So Apps for Education accounts will no longer have Google adverts displayed by default.
I thought that it was actually being removed. I thought you weren't going to be able to turn it back on either.
I think I saw the word default in the article, then. But it might have been relating to something else. So emails and documents no longer have data harvested for advertising. And apparently, if you log in with a K-12, which is an American education thing, account to Google search, it won't advertise to you then either.
Oh, right. That's interesting.
Does it have Safe Search on as well?
It always has Safe Search on by default.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh. I don't know.
Not on Tony's computers.
I've never had reason to turn it off. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right, but, officer.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting seeing these two stories together because you know, one of the, well, certainly me working in the education sector, there's a lot of sort of concern over people using cloud services like this and data protection around students' data if someone's going to be harvesting data from students' work and emails. Is that going to be safe? Is that going to be under data protection? So now it comes out that actually it might be at risk from USA government agencies, and suddenly Google say, oh, actually, we're not going to do that for you anymore then.
Yeah, interesting.
But then I suppose they could still just get the data which is on the servers, so it's not that much of a protection if this ruling is upheld.
Well, there we go. I hope it won't be.
Oh, and it's me.
Yep. That's why we're all looking at you.
Tony was feeling badly.
Yes. Developer Antimatter 15 has released Project Naptha, a browser extension that uses text recognition to allow selection, copying, editing, and translation in images on the web.
This is awesome. It's the best thing I've seen
so
today.
So if you've got a bitmap image, I don't necessarily mean a .bmt, I mean a non-vector image, so a JPEG, a PNG, or a GIF. On the web,
like a lolcat
picture.
Like
a picture on the web,
a picture on the web with some text on it. Then this lets you select that text like it was just normal text.
Yeah, like it was an overlaid piece of text in a document.
And then you can edit it or you can delete it, and it'll fill in the background.
Squint a little bit.
You can like shove it through a translation service, and it'll overlay the translation on the image.
It really is awesome.
Or you can copy it and paste it into a text document.
And call for accessibility.
Why on earth would you need to be able to do this? It sounds cool, but who cares, honestly?
Okay, well, yeah, if some idiot has posted a thing on Facebook, which is a load of, instead of actually posting a post, is an image of some text. It's usually not worth reading, yes. But if you don't know, if you can't see it, then you don't know that, whereas this could recognize the text and read it out to you
if you can't see it, you could be missing out on all kinds of homilies.
I like those pictures that are photos with some words over the top of them. Memes. By a famous person.
Memes?
No, like a quote.
Oh,
I see a lot of those on Facebook.
Oh, from your friends and family who are
not specifically
wanting to share their nuggets of wisdom that were shared with them.
Yeah, not specifically with my family.
Say you'd just taken some photos which were being featured on a CD cover, and you wanted to copy the title of that CD cover just so that you had the title verbatim and you hadn't made any mistakes. Then you could just copy and paste it off that image if you were, for instance, posting it on your blog.
I think it's one of those things where once you have it enabled, you can see how you would use it, because like under normal circumstances, when you're browsing the web and there's a picture that's got a piece of text on it, you know you can't select that. If someone said to me, like if I'm looking at an image which is like a promotional poster of, I don't know, an invitation to a party or something, and it's got the location, the postcode and all that kind of stuff to where it is, I could just select the postcode off the poster rather than type it in and save valuable time.
Yeah.
But I think it's one of those things that you know that if you've got a document open, you could just highlight any piece of text and just copy and paste it somewhere. Whereas an image, you mentally know you can't just grab a chunk of text off it. But with this enabled, it kind of makes you think, I could.
I bet your children's children won't have that mental block.
Yeah.
They'll just go, it's text, it's an image, whatever. Yeah.
It's just bits.
The one thing I want to try it on is I've got this. I requested a German journal article from the library, and because it's from the 80s, it's just a scan of like an image scan. Mm. It's not got any OCR or anything, and I don't speak German, so I'm going to have to translate it. So I was going to translate it through Google Translate after doing the OCR, and so I might just try it with this and see what happens. Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah.
So currently the extension is only available for Chrome and Chromium, but support for other browsers is planned. The guy said if you go to projectnaptha.com, there is a box to put your email address in. He says if he gets lots of people signing up, then he'll look at doing a Firefox version of it soon.
Does it all work locally, or does it send the image off to the cloud and do the analysis in the cloud or something?
I don't know.
Client side, I think.
It's all client side.
Yeah. Client side, yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
So I think I only skimmed it, but I think what's on the website isn't the full power of it because we obviously don't have the plugin installed, so he's just mimicking it on the way you can practice with it.
Well, and we've talked for so long, we don't have much time now for our gaming news.
Oh, that's a shame, Tony.
But very quickly, I'm sure you'll
tell us as much as you know. I'll
try and squeeze it all in. So don't interrupt me again. I won't interrupt you.
I know that you could talk for minutes about this stuff.
Seconds even.
Tell us, Tony.
You realise you're wasting your own valuable time here, not mine.
Go on, you've got a minute.
Okay, so Unity 3D have demonstrated the new WebGL export feature of the upcoming version 5 of their popular game development tool.
What does that mean?
It means that you can export to WebGL in the new version of the software that they're going to be releasing at some point in the future.
Okay, and what does that allow you to do?
Export to WebGL. I think I said that
yeah,
already.
So what's
are you
the
listening, Mark?
Sorry, what, so what, I'm just curious what the advantage of being able to export a Unity
it
game
sounds
to WebGL
exciting.
Is.
It sounds very Web 20.
Well, if you if you hadn't talked for so long earlier, you would be able to find out more about it.
Have we run out of time?
Almost, no. But there's just time to tell you quickly that the demo features Dead Trigger 2, which was the snuff version of Only Fools and Horses.
Too soon, Tsunami.
Runs in a modern browser with no plugins required. So basically you can play games on the web.
Awesome.
I played Chucky Egg on the web years ago.
It doesn't mention Chucky Egg in the article that I read. I mean, that I intrinsically know.
I tried playing this on my desktop and it works surprisingly well. And it's just...
So this is 3D accelerated games.
Yeah. I mean, there's like billions of layers between my web browser and the 3D card right down the bottom of the stack. You know, it feels like it shouldn't be that fast, that there's so much in between that, you know, natively compiling a game for, you know, assembly language, that machine code that runs on the CPU and calls that go to the 3D card, that should be super fast. Having like a whole desktop and a browser and all this other stuff and JavaScript in between just feels like it shouldn't be fast, but it's pretty amazing. Wow. It uses mscriptum, which allows you to compile applications into JavaScript. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
3D accelerated JavaScript.
Sorry, Tony, I didn't mean to steal.
Sorry, Tony.
Oh, sorry.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, you just stolen his thunder there.
See, now I'm annoyed with you as well.
Oh, God.
I'm not going to look at you anymore either.
You're going to...
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If you hear something that tickles, titillates, or taunts you, tweet us at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook, and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. We really would like to hear from you, so go on, do your duty, keep calm, and compose an email.
Suppose you want me to do the community news now, don't you?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm going to do it anyway.
Fine.
So... In the previous episode, we talked about 1404 and what an amazing release with no bias that was.
Secure, is it?
And
whatever.
Yeah, there have been a few interesting bugs that have turned up.
There's one that
there was a lot of hand-wringing in the community that, oh gosh, how did this happen? Which was if you lock the screen and then hold the enter key down, you can explode Unity to a point where you can get to the desktop again.
Oh, yeah.
Without typing the password in. That's a bit of a flaw. But it turns out that was fixed before the release. Sorry. It was found the day before the release and fixed, like, pretty promptly. So it was kind of, you know, panic over. That's not a problem.
But that was something that was reported allegedly a long time ago.
No, not that one. I don't think that one was. Oh. I think that one was found and reported on the 16th of April and fixed on the 17th.
Oh, okay.
On the day of release. Right. There are others, though.
Yeah.
Don't worry, I've got a few here. Yeah. There was also one where one of the scopes, the Reddit scope that allows you to search from the dash off to a number of places, and one of the sources was Reddit, and there was a lot of hang-wringing and finger-pointing and, oh my God, danger Will Robinson and all that kind of stuff, because it was leaking data that you typed into the dash.
When you say leaking data, what does that actually mean?
Well, yeah, so when you do a search in the Dash, yes, it sends that to the Canonical Scope server, and then the Scope server figures out which are the best places to send that to. So if you type in KISS, it might send it to like music search and you know, other books or whatever. But it may also send it to Reddit to search for threads on Reddit that might be interesting, or subreddits that might be interesting. And it turns out that the piece of text gets sent to Reddit, but it gets sent in such a way that it actually appears in the logs for that Reddit. So if an admin on that, on Reddit, on this third party site, yes, is looking through the logs, they can see these pieces of text that have come from the Canonical server.
Right.
How would Canonical pass them on without passing them on?
Well, I think there was a problem in that it wasn't using SSL. So there was the possibility that someone could do a man in the middle attack, not between you and Canonical, but between Canonical and Reddit.
Yeah.
And see the traffic.
But isn't it anonymized at that point anyway?
Well, yeah. unless you type, my name is Alan and I am searching Reddit for,
you know, donkeys.
Then, yeah, or whatever picture I want.
Yeah.
Then, you know, yeah, it is. And yeah, there was a lot of finger pointing, and it all kind of got a little bit heated.
Is
and
it fixed
a bit
now?
A bit out, yeah. I believe so. Fixes in the works. But then another one came up. So there's a whole bunch of these like celebrity bugs that it seems that the community and people outside the community are kind of jumping on them in the same way that they have over a period of time. But there seems to be a lot of focus on it this week, just after 1404 has come out.
Maybe they should have tried using it beforehand to commit some better tests.
Well, some have argued that, you know, yeah, you should have. But some have argued that Canonical should have QA'd it better. But, you know, letting a bug slip in on the day before release where you can press enter and unlock the screen is a bit problematic. Another one turned up after release, which on the lock screen, if you repeatedly smack the right mouse button in the toolbar in the top right hand corner, like the battery gauge and all that, you can make the lock screen break as well.
Wow.
So yeah, there's a few of these kind of
need more Daves.
Yeah.
What?
I don't know.
I don't think that's that. Oh, I see.
Oh, Dave Morley.
Yeah, because that's the kind of crazy thing he does, but there's only so much time he's going to have, so other people need to do that too.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's been a few of those.
It's the first time anybody's ever said we need more Dave Morley, I think.
No, I think it quite a lot.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, Dave's good.
He is.
He wears hats.
He does.
Mark,
cool.
What's up next?
Systemd has landed in Ubuntu.
Woohoo! Time to get rid of Upstart. Get rid of that rubbish. Yeah, are you with me?
Who invented that rubbish?
Yeah.
And yeah, the process has begun of identifying which packages rely on Upstart scripts and porting stuff.
All of them?
A lot of stuff is actually is using sysvinit scripts, which then just have a Upstart sort of wrappy bit.
So there's the stuff that never actually got ported to Upstart, which now needs porting to systemd.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And then there's stuff that did get ported to Upstart that now needs porting to systemd.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then there's any new stuff that is written needs to be integrated with systemd.
That's already
A lot of stuff already runs on systems which use systemd. So that stuff just needs including in Ubuntu.
The power of community, some of this has already been done in Debian. They've already started. Thing that triggered this was that triggered the Ubuntu switching to Debian was that, you know, to systemd was that Debian was switching to systemd.
I was going to say, you know something we don't?
Yeah, no, I don't. And so, you know, we're starting that process as well. As soon as 1404 came out, we open up the archive for 1410, the Unculus, whatever it is, and soon after that, we start synchronizing packages in from Debian. And some of those have already got, you know, all the systemd stuff already done.
So what's systemd give us that Upstart didn't? What's wrong with Upstart?
No, let's not get here.
Scott did a lot of work on that.
Yeah, he did. And
then he left.
Yeah, but then, you know, Debian have decided to move to systemd, and so we will move with them. Yeah, that's going
to
happen.
The alternative presumably is that Canonical/Ubuntu would have to have maintained separate packages for all of the things that Debian had moved to systemd.
I don't think necessarily separate packages, but we definitely need to make sure we've
patches
like them. keep Upstart working, because you know, it already works for all our packages. We just have to keep it working, and then any new stuff that arrives that's only systemd and sysvinit, we'd have to make sure that works.
So Upstart was created by Scott when he was at Canonical.
Yeah, years ago.
So who creates systemd?
Leonard Pottering and Kay Sievers, I think.
For what organization?
I think it was before they started at Red Hat, but they both work at Red Hat now.
Right.
Yeah. So apparently, the story goes, Scott created Upstart, and at some point, Leonard was going to help with Upstart, and there were discussions where Scott was giving Leonard things that he could work on Upstart, and instead, Leonard went away and created System D.
Mm-hmm.
And once the whole decision-making process about Debian switching started coming about, that's the point at which it came out that Leonard and Kay said, hey, if it wasn't for the Canonical CLA, we wouldn't have created System D. Or that's a trigger that made it happen, because if they were going to contribute to Upstart, they would have had to sign the Canonical CLA.
CLA?
The
contributor license
contributor agreement.
Where you sign copyright over, basically.
Well, no, you don't. You don't.
You just assign the rights for them to
redistribute
it as they wish.
Yeah. Right. So they were saying, you know, well, this is back a few months ago. But we've all got past that now. It's fine. It's fine.
What was Debian doing before?
They just had SysV in it.
So who else uses System D now?
Everyone.
Except Chrome OS and us. And every derivative of Ubuntu.
It's Ubuntu?
All of the flavors use Upstart. You can carry on listing them, but now I've said all of them, you don't need
to. My
Everybody is dead, Dave.
Everybody.
Nice reference.
Moving on.
Excellent. Laura, what's up next?
There's a new Ubuntu support channel. No, not another one.
Oh, good.
And it's been launched for people who like Reddit. Specifically, those people.
So when you say support, where you can actually get technical help for problems.
Yes.
Oh. The announcement basically says, it's a post on the Ubuntu subreddit that says, some people don't like Ask Ubuntu, so I'm making a subreddit, which is basically Ask Ubuntu.
So, yeah, I was going to say, because when you ask a question on Reddit, people can vote you up and down and comment and answer.
I understand it's a very very popular question and answer sort of thing, that voting up and down.
So, yeah.
So just to take it back, what's Reddit?
Oh, bless. Ooh. It's the front page of the internet, Tony.
It's sort of like a forum, but not a forum.
I'm not sure I'm cut out for this podcast anymore.
You just keep twiddling your knobs.
So long as you've got your gaming news, we're all right. Okay, you're still relevant to me.
I still have a job to do.
So basically, Reddit has a bunch of sub-forums, which are called subreddits.
But they're not forums.
No, they're like forums in that you post and there are threads.
Alan approves of them, unlike forums.
Yeah, exactly.
Alan approves.
Well, the reason I prefer them over forums is because forums don't generally have the rating system that allows me to go into one thread and see all the interesting stuff and not have to see all the garbage.
Yeah.
Which forums do have, and Reddit is brilliant for that. But it has lots of special interest subreddits of any kind of interest. You could. There are probably even subreddits about wedding photography.
Really?
There is one about Doctor Who.
There will be many about Doctor Who, I imagine.
There's loads of threads on there. Anyway, so there's this one that's about Ubuntu, and people post news articles and then discuss it, or they post announcements and they might not get discussion, but sometimes people post support questions, and what they're trying to do is push people towards a dedicated support area.
Cool. Well, it's always good to have additional support channels, as long as they can be supported and helpful answers given. I suppose that's the risk, isn't it? Diluting the efforts across a number of different channels.
I don't think it is diluting.
No, it's about choice.
Well, it's not. No, it's not about choice. It's about putting support where the people who need support are.
Yeah. And where those people who might offer support are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is probably a good thing, actually.
Yeah, you need both, really.
Yeah.
It's like a giant echo chamber of, oh, I need support too. Do you need support? Yes, I do.
Let's all sit together.
There were, you know, a web place where you can do that, like some sort of site on the web where you can go to, is a good way of doing that.
Yes. Someone set him off. Cool. Is that all of the community news?
I think it might be.
I think we need a break.
Oh.
And that's all for episode 5. We'll be back next week with an interview with Michael Meeks and Bjorn
Michelson. Very well done.
About the Open Document Foundation and LibreOffice. And we'll also have all your feedback.
Cool. Yeah, and a command line love as well, I think.
Oh, and a command line love.
You can never get away without a command line love.
Lovely.
Oh, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye. Goodbye. Bye.